Good morning, everyone. My name is Kyle Bowen. I'm the Director of Informatics at Purdue University. For those of you I haven't had a chance to meet yet, pretty warm and fuzzy guy. So as you have any questions today, feel free to just kind of blurt those out, although I've been reminded you're supposed to use the microphone. So feel free to just run over to the microphone anytime. And also for the folks listening in online, love to hear what questions you have. Also today we have Eden Dahlstrom from ECAR. And she'll be talking a lot about student data, and we'll loop back to that here just a little bit. So what we really want to talk today is how perspectives have changed based on the presence of new technology. In particular, if we think about conversation, just the regular notion of conversation that has existed for a very long time. Now, I don't mean kind of the 21st century meaning of conversation. I mean like IRL conversation, face-to-face style conversation. Has it died away? I mean, have we moved beyond that concept? You know, it's not hard to imagine because just simply look what it's up against. Smartphones, text messaging, social media, these are the four horsemen of the talkpocalypse. They have changed how we approach conversation in every facet. Conversation, in many ways, never really stood a chance. It simply lacks the features of all of its competitors. You can't like a conversation. You can't post it on a wall. You can't put it in a circle. You can check in from a conversation, but you won't be getting any badges for it. Nobody ever became mayor of a conversation. You can't save a conversation for later, not without being kind of creepy about it anyway. And you can't search for a conversation, although I'm sure it's not due to Google's lack of trying. But you see, the real death punch from conversation comes from the fact that conversation is no longer mobile. Wait a minute. Now, how can that be? The whole point of a mobile device was to enable conversation anywhere. But is that what's happened? You see, the mobile device has not become about enabling conversation. It's about actively avoiding them. Think about it for a minute. I bet every one of us has a friend that if we called them on the phone right now, they would never answer. But if we texted them, they'd text us right back. Right? What does that say about your relationship? I gave you my number. I didn't want you to actually call me. You know, sure, we're friends, but you're not more than 140 characters interesting. See, the other thing is that we use our phones to do is to avoid conversation, right? There's metrics on this. It suggests a certain percentage of people, around 15% of people, will use their mobile device to fake a phone call. Many of us have probably done this. You're walking through Target, you see that person you went to high school with, you didn't like them then, you don't really want to talk to them now, so what do? You pull out your phone and pretend to have a conversation. Right? Then you just walk on by, hey, I'm on the phone with the White House here, I've dialed numbers and everything, you know, I can't possibly put this down, and you just move on. The other thing that we typically do is that we use them to end a conversation. We're sitting in a coffee house or a bar and a song comes on. Now, typically we would have spent the entire evening debating who actually sang that song. Was it Kenny Loggins or was it Two Live Crew? We can't quite be certain of which it was. But now we pull out our device and within seconds we know the answer. And it turns out we both share love for the same Justin Bieber song. See, this is what has happened is that our perspectives have changed. And technology is what changes it. So part of what we have to do is understand this. We have to understand this at a very high level across the world, across our institutions, across higher education. But then what we have to do is take that information and drill down on it and understand what does it mean for us locally. One identifies an overall trend and the other indicates what's happening on the ground for me right now. And those two things can work hand in hand. And so that's what we want to talk about today, is that how can we take things like the ECAR student study and use that as a guidepost to say, look, these are the trends. Here are the things that are emerging across higher education. And then how can we take that and apply them inside of our own institutions and use them to fuel additional study so that we can better understand specific aspects of what we want to do locally. Right now I'm going to introduce Eden so that she can begin to talk about the ECAR story.
All right. It's good to be here today. We started out with a slide that had a Star Trek reference, but more importantly, it was the data versus Deanna concept. And the idea behind this sort of research is that you need to have the analytical skills to be able to do the research and run some numbers, but you also have to have the communication skills and the emotional intelligence to understand the utility of that. So I'm going to talk to you about a study that we do every year within EDUCAUSE, and it's called the Student Technology Study. This is the 10th year that we're doing it. And I'll show you a picture, and it's a little morbid, but the story behind this picture is sitting in a room with college administrators that came out of the community college system in California, and we were talking about, things like how to better schedule classes for students and counseling and student services sorts of things. And the student worker that was in my office comes up to me and he said, you know what, this is what it feels like to go to college. And so you can see that there's the catapults going from K-12, throwing them over this big transom, getting them to the college or university. And it's a little hectic and confusing for them. And so all of us educated administrators sat back and we went, we need to ask students what they want. And so this slide is a little old, and I don't have any technology infused into it. But my question for the ECAR student study is, how do we use technology to make this sort of stuff better for students? So this year's student study, we actually had four broad thematic messages that we were able to ferret out of the data and what the undergraduates told us. And the first one is that blended learning and technology really are a winning combination to engage students. I'll show you some slides on this, but I'll tell you what the four things are. The second one was really about the proliferation of devices and the bring-your-own technology and how students want to use these and how diverse these technologies are for them. The third thing has to do with the students' acknowledgement of how important it is to have technology in their lives and the potential for it to enhance their academic experiences. And the fourth one has to do with communication. They recognize that they have a broad audience and diverse audience that they're talking to, and they don't always want to use the same forms of communication through technology to talk to these folks. So let's just take a look at these. Students tell us that they like blended learning environments. And we know that they've taken online courses. This is nothing new. But just how has this changed just in the last 3 or 4 years? Experiences are up. You know, how much? Over 100%. Twice as many students are taking online courses today. And we didn't even ask about MOOCs in 2012. We'll ask about those in 2013. But we know that students are infused with technology, and they have this expectation to have technology in their courses, whether it's something as simple as access to a course or learning management system, or if there's some sort of instructional design component involved in this hybrid course nature. And this is something that is concerning to the teaching and learning folks, and as someone who's been in the classroom, it's something that certainly is concerning. You don't want technology to supplant what you do as an instructor, but we hear from students that things like putting a lecture online doesn't keep them from going to class for most students. So that's good news. Really, technology can supplement their experience. Also, I can read this particular data point in two ways. I can say, wow, half of students say that they're more actively involved in courses. Or I could say, wow, only half of students are more actively engaged. So there's both challenge here, but there's also the acknowledgement that technology enhances that. And who are the engagement winners? So we ask students to rate things based on these long inventories of various types of technology. And the two that emerge as the top, and these were the only two that were over a majority of students, were simulations and educational games and open educational resources. And these top things like using more multimedia activities in classes, or using ebooks, or course and learning management system. These are the things that students are telling us that they want. Part of this feels like a statement of the obvious, but we know that students bring their own technology to school. This has been happening for a long time, and let's just see what they can tell us about that experience for them. We know there's a trend for towards mobility, and we've tracked the same data over a number of years. You can see from 2004 how the trends have changed. Smartphones replaced feature phones. We know that. That happened around 2007. Most students have laptops, but it sort of tapered off. You can see in the last couple of years we've asked about e-readers and tablets. I also like to keep the PDA on there. because when you were in 2004, if you had a PDA, you were pretty cool. I mean, you had your schedule, it was in your palm, and it was electronic. So things drop off and other things replace that. But there's some wows here. That's a huge percentage increase in the number of students carrying these mobile devices. You know, what are we doing actively and strategically to use those as tools for them? And I'll dive in a little deeper here, too, to what types of devices students say they own. And almost everybody owns a laptop. This is universal, regardless of Carnegie class. Though community colleges, students own fewer of these, but they have desktops or their institutions provide more lab space for them. Smartphones, 62%. That's up from last year. It was 55%, so we know this is growing. Desktops, we just can't get rid of them. Maybe we don't want to. But I'm going to crown the laptops queen or king, whatever your preference is there, because you just can't beat them for issues of productivity. But let's juxtapose these data with how students say they use them for academic purposes. Desktops. I'll just pause there for a moment. Now, these data are for all students, regardless of whether or not they own the particular device. So this gives you a broad understanding of just looking at students across your campus. If you control for ownership, use goes up most substantially for smartphones. And for smartphones, which is, you know, 2 out of every 3 students own one on your campus, almost all of them use them for academic purposes. And that's up substantially from last year. It was only about a third. Oh, is there a question?
Do we have data on students who have no mobile device?
Do we have data?
No tablet, no laptop, no smartphone.
Do we have data on students that don't own a mobile device? We do. We can back out of that by looking at how many students answered no to all of these questions. But we haven't done anything with those data. Yeah. So more importantly than what devices students use, what are they using them for? Granted, we asked them a limited number of questions about how they use these things, but the thing that stands out here for me is that they're using them for course access stuff. So they want to be able to access their CMS or their LMS or materials. They're not using them for transactional things. And this is their rating of importance here. So, you know, why is it not important for them to be able to register on class? It's because, or register online using a mobile device for a class. You know, I don't know. But it's kind of curious to remind ourselves that students say they want to use these for academics. Transactional stuff, not so much. Not yet. So it's important to talk about the diversity. I know Kyle has done some research at Purdue about this, and he has some slides where he's going to talk about the native versus non-native app. And just a good reminder about what types of technology students own in terms of brands and market share. So for laptops, very much Windows. Smartphones, about even between iPhones and Androids. Tablets, iPads, and e-readers or Kindles. So it's diverse, and it's just going to get more creative as technologies advance and more open resources allow access to various types of platforms. So using technology, and this again is a statement of the obvious, you know, it provides an opportunity here for a positive response for students. But let's give some accommodations here. This is a snippet that you can walk away with and use as a case for why technology is good. You know, I give thumbs up to the technology helps students achieve their student outcomes. But when you look at what types of devices they say are important, I always want this to be different, but for the last couple of years it's been the same. And these three here really make up the trifecta. These are the three winners. You can't beat a laptop for productivity. You can't beat a printer for not only being able to proofread your projects, but to have a backup of whatever it is that you submit electronically to your instructor. And portability, you have those thumb drives. Now, of course, we'll see this change. I fully expect thumb drives to drop off in the next couple of years because of all of the cloud-based technology. But this is not where you would think it was, given how many students have things like smartphones and how many more students today have tablets than they had a couple of years ago. It's still not seen as something that is part of their sort of repertoire of tools. So again, that I think provides us with a real opportunity, and I know that there's been a lot of discussions here about the challenges around technology, and some really cool things are happening with the implementation of mobile devices on campus. So this is a lot of data on this chart, so let me just walk you through it. We have 3 years of data, and we're looking at the percentage of students who say they use these particular resources. So it goes from 2010 to 2012, and these all have pretty steep trajectories. A lot more students are doing these things now than they were a couple of years ago. And at the very end, you see a circle. And the size of the circle really represents the magnitude of importance. So I'll pull out a couple of things here. So when you compare 2010 to 2012, you have 7 times as many students using ePortfolios. That's a lot of students, but you'll also notice that that's the purple line is the ePortfolio line on the chart there, and it's also the least used thing out of this in particular inventory. 5 times as many students use web-based citation tools, and 3 times as many used eText. So these 3 things are all on the lower end there. So, you know, these are really things that are coming up and moving out as emerging technologies. And this is something that I have to remind myself every time I look at the student study data, that technology literacy isn't innate. And in the U.S., two out of three students say that they were prepared to use technology when they came to college. That's awesome. But that means 1 out of 3 is not. That's a lot. And then this piece of data asks them or shows how many more want to be more skilled or trained in technology. And it moves to 2 out of 3 say they want to be more skilled or trained. So that's interesting. Where are they getting this training? Well, half of them say their instructors are doing it. The instructors are the ambassadors. I think for the ELI crowd, that's really an important piece of information to have. It's students look to their instructors for this sort of training, and half of them say they're getting this. And so continuing the theme on listening to students, we've asked for the last couple of years about how they want to communicate with others. And it's not necessarily the same around. So only 2 in 5 say that they want to connect with their instructors through social networks. We have to be really careful about how we engage students and where the line is between providing opportunities for students to interact with one another and how close the instructor is to that conversation. And then I'm going to give a thumbs up on the other side to provide opportunities to students to engage with one another. And then in the middle here, we say that let's just keep in mind that students like to keep their academic lives and social lives separate. Let's respect that when we're doing these sorts of things. So, what should we use more? How should we be communicating with students? We didn't ask about face-to-face interaction last year. So, in 2011, email was the primary winner here. But students say they want face-to-face interaction more than any other technology communication opportunity. That's really interesting, especially in the context of all of the things that we've learned this last week about MOOCs. You know, what's going on there? How do we take this information? How do we use it? These are all of the things I'm going to call out that had an increase of over 20%. You know, these are the things that changed by at least 20% last year compared to this year. Okay, this is a really heavy data slide as well. So I like to layer data. So we ask questions in various types of ways on the survey, and then we sort of pick them apart. We deconstruct and reconstruct. And so I'll walk you through this. The green bars are the percentage of students who said that they wanted a particular form of communication used more. So you see the face-to-face up there is the highest, communicating through course and learning management systems next, email next. So then we have a light green line, and that's the comparison for the percentage of students who said last year that they wanted these things used more. So you can see how that's changed. I put the red dots there because on that spectrum of whether or not a student told us they wanted to use something more, we asked them if they wanted us to use it less. And so you can see the juxtaposition between the extreme use it more and the extreme use it less. And I think the real interesting part of the story here is where the green bars and the red dots converge.
What's going on there? Is this a transition between something that used to be done that's not done anymore, or is this something that's emergent? So that's the area that I like to pay attention to. Was there a question? No. Okay. So, let's see. We walked through that. And, Kyle. Sure. Can you use the mic?
On the last slide, if you wouldn't mind putting, thank you. So what you're saying is they don't want the use of social media sites. They want people to use that less. Is that what that red dot says?
The red dot is the percentage of students who say use it less.
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. That's very interesting because I know that there's a big push at some, among some faculty members, that's at least at our institution, to say, oh, we need to be using social media sites more as part of our education. So I find this very interesting.
But, you know, and that could be true. So, and one of the things that I didn't talk to you about with the student study is that we partner with institutions to gather information from students. And then we take those data and we write this annual report that we can talk to you about very broadly. But if you participate in the student study, we give you data about what your students say, and we compare that with what students say nationally and also what students say compared to other institutions like yours. So we can give you a little more information about what your students say when you participate, and it would be interesting to see how the culture and context is different at your institution or whether it's the same.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Online question?
The online audience wanted to know if your presentation will be available on the EDUCAUSE site after today.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
So at Purdue, we've been focusing on this initiative, the Studio Initiative, that really where we're trying to reimagine different aspects of the learning experience and really taking advantage of emerging trends and capitalizing on them to help our faculty and students be more successful. And that's where this kind of information is really helpful to us. Because really what we want to know is, now that we're seeing these emerging trends, what does it mean to us on the ground? And that's a term I like to use because it means in the actual classroom, when the instructor's engaging with their students, whether that be both virtual or physical, that you know, we need to understand better what's actually going on there. But that can be very difficult to measure, especially doing it at scale. There's... FEMA uses something called the Waffle House Index. Anybody ever heard of the Waffle House Index? No? So this is an actual measure that FEMA uses to determine the level of devastation on the ground after a major natural disaster. And what it says is that when you have something, let's say, like a hurricane or a tornado, what they do is they can judge how bad the devastation was based on how the Waffle House is operating in that area. So what it says is that if the Waffle House is open and serving warm meals, then, well, how bad could it have been? Or at the other end of the scale, if the Waffle House is closed, then that must be borderline Armageddon or something like it. So what we really need to look for are indicators like that. And that's really what this begins to show us at a macro level. What are these Waffle House-like indicators of what's going on? Also, what we want to do are use it to begin to inform decisions that we're making. So as we develop new technology, what we want to try to avoid is Schrodinger's app. The idea that the app is both successful and not successful at the same time. Right? This is a concept that we don't want it to just be a shot in the dark. We want it to be calculated. But it can be very difficult to know everything about a particular environment before you head into it. So again, we look for indicators. What's going on? What can give us some suggestion of what might work inside of this space? So as Eden mentioned, what we were seeing was this real growth trend in terms of the use of mobile devices, interest in using more media, video, audio inside of the classroom, interest in distributing more open resources, these kinds of things, interest in reducing textbook costs in the classroom. But yet, the technologies weren't necessarily there to support it. They were there to support it in one way or another, but it wasn't really focused on how do we help the faculty member help their students do this and really take advantage of it and take away some of the issues surrounding it. So that's where we did our own study. So we looked at what ECAR had done and say, okay, let's deep dive into that specific space of using mobile devices, all right? And how, what are the students' preferences? What are their ideas around how they use mobile devices? And use that to inform, one, product development later, and two, a development approach to that. So that's where really where, as a technology organization, we operationalized that survey information to give us some indication of how we should move forward. So through that study, we learned a number of different things. The first one was really dealing with the demographic of the student in terms of their device ownership. So among smartphone owners, what we saw was 84% of them, and this is just in phones, so it doesn't include tablets, were covered on two platforms, right? So when we look at device ownership in a particular space, really, we're not talking about every device out there. Really, we're talking about a small number of platforms. And even the ones that were larger, so in this case, the next closest one is in the purple there is BlackBerry, which was, according to our study, in steep decline among students. So of students who are planning to buy a smartphone in the next 6 months, the vast majority of them were not planning on buying a BlackBerry, right? So that was a number that was going to shrink over time. So now that we know that the technology is present, and really there's some commonality among how that technology was being used, what we wanted to know was, how did the students feel about their use of it? And what we found were that the predominance of students recognized themselves as being intermediate or advanced users of the technology, right? And our study can expand on that a little bit more, but they didn't see themselves as beginners, right? They were coming into it with having owned the device, and actually what we found is they had owned it for a fair amount of time already. So even those that identified themselves as novice users had owned their device for 5 months, right? With some of them having owned their device for 3 years or more. Now, we also found that there was a real conscious use of bandwidth. And so what this chart shows you is how often they use specifically their cellular bandwidth. Okay, so this is not Wi-Fi. When not connected to Wi-Fi, what are the things you use? And we selected using your web browser, download apps, and downloading videos more or less as a proxy for how much bandwidth you're consuming. And it's just three examples. And what we found was it kind of went down as the theoretical size of the media got bigger. Whereas on one end, students may surf the web using their smartphone all the time, yet downloading a video, even if you look in the yellow, is the never category. So a third of students would never use their phone to download a video when not connected to a wireless network. So this is actually in contrast to the idea of using more media. Right? And even from an institution's perspective, it says if the student's going to do it, that puts an increased reliance on our wireless network in the classroom. Right? So these are all issues that have to be overcome as part of this process. And so really what it cooked down to us was for one question to fuel moving forward, the question of native versus neutral. Right? How do we approach this? And this is a real challenge. So for anybody pursuing a mobile initiative, this is a key question to go into. Do you develop the native app and deploy it on a specific platform? So do you develop an app specifically for iOS and specifically for Android, or do you go neutral and you put it online? What we wanted to understand from our students was, does it matter? Because we had early on at our own institution made decisions around, well, clearly the web is the future of mobile. That's what we'll adopt. That's what we'll drive into. But yet we saw some interesting things happening in the classroom. Was that the lack of presence in the App Store, for example, meant that it wasn't a mobile app. So when we had a web app for a particular product, they would never think to use it on their phone. Because while I looked in the App Store, it wasn't there, so I don't use it on my phone. So what we wanted to do is understand that because they had a preference there that manifested itself in use. What we found was that 70% of students found the native applications just overall easier to use, right? Same amount said they were faster, right? So we're dealing with the same collection of data, but what they see is the perception, right or wrong, that these things are just easier and faster, and that's why I prefer to use the native app. Then what we wanted to dive down into a little bit deeper was, how are you using them in specific categories? What is your preference? And what you can see here, and I'm not going to go over all of them, but what you can see here is just on basic categories of usage of types of apps, there is a predominance in terms of a preference for using a native app, whereas the only ones that get close are dealing with reference information and shopping, right? And reference information dealing with largely searches and things like that. If we take this same concept and we begin to apply it to concepts in higher education or specifically related to teaching and learning, we see a very similar effect. A heavy reliance on or interest in native mobile applications. So what that said to us was as we move forward with developing technology that really helps our students or helps our faculty to deliver interactive content or rich media and do it wirelessly, how do we need to approach that in a very effective way? So the next part we looked at is what were their preferences for reading their or consuming textbooks, as an example. And what we found was generally half wanted to consume it from a mobile app, whereas only a quarter wanted to consume it from the web. Yeah. Preferences. Yeah.
Because a lot of these are only available, say, through an app that can't get into the LMS system except through the university provided or the vendor provided app.
So the question is this was this derived from a question about preference, or was it derived from a question about how they currently do it? The phrasing of the actual question was dealing with if the service were available, how would you prefer to do it? Yeah, good question. So what we did was we took that information, we used it to fuel development of technology called Jetpack. Right? And Jetpack was designed to kind of overcome the traditional challenges that we had with delivering rich information inside of the classroom. It took advantage of the mobile apps. It allows us to put them on multiple different phones. We had native apps looking to take advantage of those elements. And the other part it did was it made it easy for our faculty to package media and to distribute it to multiple different platforms. They didn't have to understand the complexity of, I have this video, I want it viewable on an iPhone, an Android phone, and on the web all at the same time. What format do I put it into? What are the nuances of each platform? Really what it did was it said, okay, we'll just make it turnkey. You just upload the video and it just kind of figures it out and distributes it from there. The other obstacle we had to overcome was one that we saw with a lot of e-text platforms, which was they had heavy DRM, which means that accessing the text even in the classroom was problematic because it was consuming so many of the wireless resources in the room. So what we wanted to do was have a way to securely distribute content but not have this heavy reliance on the wireless infrastructure. So what we did was took advantage of the native capabilities of these applications where it actually stores that content on the device. So in a very TiVo-like way, it downloads now so you can watch it later. Right? So you download the content in your dorm room, at Starbucks, at McDonald's, wherever you have bandwidth, and you walk around with it on your phone, which means that it's also not reliant on having a connection at any particular time. So you're using it on the bus, or in some of our disciplines, they're using it in the field, in places where there isn't a connection to be had. So really what we saw was this need, and we embraced it in this particular way, and this is how we used that data to fuel that process. But one of the ways that we needed to approach it, one of the challenges we had, was how do we do that? So we recognize this need. We need these native apps. We need to put them in place. So how do we make that happen? And so what we want to do is use the data, use the information we had on hand to inform a development process. And really, I don't really like to call it a process. I really like to call it more of a practice, right? To say, how should we pursue these things? So one of the challenges with developing mobile applications is you have to develop specifically to the platform. Now, there are these intermediary technologies that have come out, like Appcelerator or PhoneGap, these kinds of frameworks where they're designed so that you can develop once and deploy to multiple different platforms. And so we started off down that path. Our thinking being, well, if we could design an app once and combine the best of both worlds, wouldn't that just be awesome? That would be Sharktopus and DinoShark, right? The classic sci-fi network shows. You take two awesome things, you merge them together, and that makes them clearly doubly awesome. But really, when we tried to do that with iOS and Android development, it didn't work out. We ended up with something called Appleroid, which didn't go the direction we wanted it to go. See, what we tried to do there was we tried to use an intermediary technology to make it easier. We tried to replace talent with technology, and that was a huge mistake. for the time we spent trying to make the workaround work, we could have just invested in our employees and developed the competencies in them. Because we knew, based on the information we had, this was clearly a trend. Mobile devices weren't going to go away, right? They were going to continue to grow in usage and in numbers, as technologies had done before them. So what we needed to do as an organization was to invest in having the talent to begin to build that out. And we can begin to develop and solve some of these classic teaching and learning problems that have existed. Things as simple as distributing interactive media. Things as simple as coming up with true alternatives to e-books. You know, these types of concepts that the e-car study was beginning to outline, that these are interests of our students, these are the trends, let's capture them. Right? So this is the promise that these kinds of changes in perspectives have. Because what we see is this kind of growth in the idea of, you know, using these devices. But the thing is they're not new ideas themselves. Right? The iPad, for example, it was not a new idea. It was first foretold in the movies. I think it was Kubrick's in 2001. But then later, more, I think, accurately depicted in Star Trek The Next Generation, where Captain Picard used a device actually called a pad. There's a picture of it there. See, what was fantastic about this to me was that in the Star Trek universe, while tablets were a technology they had cracked, clearly they had not figured out the cure for male baldness. See, this is our opportunity, right? That we have this growing acceptance and use of the technology, and what we can do is kind of reposition ourselves. And what we can do is look at what are the early indicators, what are the emerging trends, and then we can deep dive onto those so that, unlike Schrodinger's app, we're making calculated decisions. We don't have to wonder whether or not the app's going to work or not. We have something that suggests we're placing bets in the right places. With that, I'm going to trade it back off to Eden so she can talk a little bit more about how to get involved with the e-car study.
Well, any questions for Kyle before I talk about this?
Well, really one for both of you, if I could, if you'd indulge me. It seems to me that a lot of the applications that are being developed and that you've mentioned are media consumption-centric, right? The applications that allow students to do things like register for classes, which you mentioned, I don't know that we're there yet simply because there's an advisor, there's a person that has to serve as a medium there. And students can't just go out and freely, typically on most campuses, just register themselves for all their courses that they want without having some sort of an advisor. And there's usually a token or something that's a process. So do you think we'll ever get to the point where students can actually that becomes virtualized through a mobile device, that experience of registering for classes, payment, those types of things?
Sure. I think we certainly, you know, as part of an evolutionary process, I think everything will eventually be mobilized, for lack of a better term. But the question is at what point does it become reasonable? So we're at this point right now where we're making early investments in these technologies. So things like that which have, let's say have low gain potential, that really there's a better experience to go and sit down with a human, so why should we really want to replace that with a mobile device, that it makes sense to invest in other areas. And so that's where really, you know, our philosophy is we should be investing the resources of research and development, especially mobile technologies, into teaching and learning and not investing them into, you know, other aspects of the institution. So really doing it for the things that are strategic. Because at this point, point in the game, there's so little, there's not as many resources to be put into mobile development than as it evolves over time. I mean, it's very similar to the day when, you know, a decade ago, most of our institutions had a webmaster. There was one guy that you went and begged to put something online, right? Now, it's multiple people, and they specialize in different ways, in many different cases. And so that's where we need to begin to build out that kind of infrastructure to support these types of mobile technologies. But that's kind of the long answer to what was a short question. But, yeah, I think just through the evolution of the technology, it all kind of gets there. Now, on our study, we looked at that just as kind of a way to say, okay, holistically, as from a student's perspective, what were their preferences, to see if there were specific areas that were different in other places or in one place or another. But generally what we saw was this overarching trend of, no, native apps were really what their expectations were.
I also think it's important to take into context the student experience. More and more, when we go onto a website, whether we're purchasing something or making travel arrangements or something of that sort, we have something that pops up that wants us to, you know, ask for some kind of advice with what we assume is a real person, but is probably some sort of algorithm-driven system. And so as students become more accustomed to those types of services, I think we really need to think about how we frame opportunities for students. You know, is talking to a real-life person in a counselor's office the best way to give that particular individual advice about their academic trajectory? And I don't have an answer for that, but you can certainly see the trends out there in other industry and business. So I think that it's coming to education. Yeah. So the ECAR study takes a really broad perspective about what's going on with students, you know, and that's useful. It gives us some good trends, and we get to talk to some media about it. But the most powerful thing about the ECAR study is that it's open to everybody, and it's free. And we can't do the research without institutional participation, so we make it as easy as possible for you to participate. And in exchange for doing a couple of things on your part, we give you data back about your students, and we help you benchmark that to other like institutions. So this slide's been up there for a while, so I won't read through it, but there's some basic information about how to get involved. We have a website, as does everybody these days, that gives you some more information about the project. And here's where we are in terms of our process for this year's study. So it's an annual study. We do data collection from mid-February to mid-April, and it's not too late to get involved because I'm so awesome with graphics in comparison to Kyle. I did this circle and line myself to show you where we are. We're actually past the official window to let us know that you want to participate in the student study, but we haven't actually opened the survey yet, so if you want to get involved, talk to me after this, or if you're online, you can email me, and we can get you on board for this next year. And there's really minimal investment on your part. And what it'll help you do is it'll help you get an idea about what your students are saying, you know, leveraging the student voice about what's going on. Now, Kyle and his team at Purdue took it a step further. They took some basic knowledge that they had from doing this sort of stuff or what our study said, and they really made it personal for what they were doing and what opportunities they had to give to their students for technology, which is why we wanted to do, which is why I wanted to do a presentation with him. Yeah. So where are we at with time, and what can we answer for you? Question. Oh.
We'll do it until they cut us off. How about that?
So, since I can't quite read everything on your graphic there, when you say it's not really too late to participate, this would be for a survey that would be offered next spring of 2014? This spring. So mm-hmm. If we can get our act together. With the IRB and all those things.
Mm-hmm. And we can help you with that. We've last year we worked with 195 institutions. This year we're probably going to be working with the 200-ish, a little bit more than that. And so we have a pretty good idea about what the IRB folks want and have done some prep materials and can walk you through it. The only thing that we need to know right now before the end of the week is if you're interested. If you are, it'll save you a placeholder, and we'll work with you on the logistics.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any online questions? No. We did such a thorough job. Okay.
Very good.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.